Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles.
Today we are going to open a whole new process in understanding how the Bible works and understanding how one generation of writers relies on stories from an earlier generation and why things may have been written the way they are written. But the whole thing here about looking at the Jacob and David parallels, it's very intriguing. It's very addictive because there's a lot of them. And the idea here is, you know, you want to try to, which came first, the chicken or the egg? It's hard to know. I think there's some clarification that has been made in by the scholars. I have some thoughts of my own. I have my own little interpretation of it. Well, we're going to save that for our next meeting because I don't think we're going to get there this time. But it just deepens your understanding of how biblical material evolves. And what are the processes from a literary and even a historical perspective? Because if you see that people at the time of David or immediately after or at some point after David existed, if you see that those accounts reflect something from the time of Jacob, which is what I call mythic history, because there is no archaeological evidence going back that far. Just if you take the generations in the Bible at face value, okay? So why are they, why does, is it that way? Okay? And I think what where the tendency is here is that these were ancient stories that were passed down initially orally, and then compiled at a certain point in time, redacted, we could say, at a time when an offshoot of that was either the reality or interpretations of the reality that was the period of David or immediately after him, around the time of David. And what drove the redaction to take place at that time specifically? And it might give some insights into what was going on, what the Bible reflects in the life of David. Because the fact of the matter is, in both instances, you have the patriarch Jacob and the king David doing things that we would be surprised, about which we would be surprised. We talked about Jacob already in this whole love affair with Matzevot, right? We talked about Abraham and his love affair with trees and noted that these are things that in later generations, even post-Davidic generations, would find to be anathema, okay? And the fact is, David, as you'll see, we talked about this, right? David had apparently in his house a big idol that sat on the floor somewhere or on a table somewhere. And his wife put it in bed, and so it would look like he was lying in bed sick, right? And that means it's right there. So how do you explain that the king, who is credited with really establishing the worship of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh as the supreme God, I mean, really making a big push, and even in how he acts and how his, when the ark is brought in, remember that his wife Michal yells and says, "How in hell are you? What are you? You're the king, and you're running around half naked. Men and women are looking at you, dancing like crazy. All you have on is something around your, you know, your to cover your, you know what's, and that's it." And you jump around in the air? Can you imagine? And David says, I am dedicated to God. I mean, it takes transcendence over everything. And if I want to share my joy, I'm going to share my joy with him. And Michal says, ah, you're crazy. Okay. I mean, he was doing that. Okay. And he was the guy that brought the ark into Jerusalem. So, you know, but on the other hand, he's got an idol in his house. So how do you explain that? All right. Is that not troubling? Yeah, it is troubling. Okay, so then when you say, well, Jacob, he put up a matzevah and poured oil on it, right? And he said, God's here. This is God's house. So, you know, David, Jacob, this is part of the way the culture was. And if you're going to accuse David, you got to accuse Jacob. You want to accuse Jacob of idolatry? You know, so it makes people have second thoughts. So was that done in an attempt to sort of make David's inconsistencies more palatable at a time when perhaps he was coming under some kind of extreme criticism? Lord knows he was a king who could justify a criticism. You know, there's more. We'll get into all that stuff. But these are the kinds of questions, and it sort of gives you an insight of how later generations interpret the past. And the thing is, we do this all the time. This is not an ancient process. We take past events and sometimes recast them in a way that makes them more meaningful or relevant to something that's going on right now. Okay? And there's many details, you know, that we could give that relate to that. Some of the mythology, I see your hand, just a second, Mark, but Tybalt's hand was up first. You know, the stories about George Washington, they've been mythologized, you know, I mean, and some of the presidents, well, we know Thomas Jefferson was a slave owner, and his favorite slave was his bedmate as well. Okay. That's the great Thomas Jefferson, right?
Silly heavens.
Yeah, right. I mean, so, all right. Anyhow, so there's nothing new under the sun in that regard. Okay, Tybal.
I just was going to say, so in my worldview, the way what happened with Michal, what happened with Bathsheba, and what happened with Abigail's first husband loom larger than the idolatry. But I think what you're saying from a Judaic point of view, the idolatry is the much bigger problem,
yeah,
not the personal ethics.
You're right. But remember, first of all, that men could have more than one wife back then.
Yeah, but they weren't supposed to kill off the existing husband so they could get them.
Of course not. But that's the point, though, you see. I mean, there's no quite. Let me just add on what David did with. As an adulterer is a big deal because it boomeranged against him. And Nathan the prophet predicted that that would happen. And it happened. So he got his comeuppance in big time. Big time. Okay? So he was punished. He was punished indirectly. It was delayed, but he was punished for that. As for the murder of Uriah, right? That is off the charts. That's off the charts. Yes. But I mean, the point is, the Bible does not cover that up. That's the point. So I would say, in addition to the way he handled the women, I agree with you. And there's no reason to push that onto the back burner. I think there are a number of issues in his life that are on the front burner. I mean, there's a secondary thing when he goes into one of the temples, remember, and he takes the 12 loaves of bread that are supposed to stay. Now, that was not a Jerusalem temple because there was no temple, right? But it was a local shrine. And apparently, according to that, they ran it with the same, based on the biblical model. And there were the 12 loaves of bread that were for the priests, that were ritual and sanctified for priests only. It said so right on, and it's baked on. Kohanim Levad, only priests, right? Along with the Heksher from the RCC. Okay, anyway, I'm supposed to laugh. All right, anyway, the point is, that was wrong, because he is not a Levite. He's a Judahite, right? But that sort of falls to a second tier. And actually, you don't find him, the interesting thing in the account of the teraphim in the bed, there doesn't seem to be any bounce back from that. It's there. It's sort of accepted as, okay, that's okay. He needed to save his life. Pikuach nefesh, toche idolatry, right? It pushes off the laws of idolatry. You got to save a person's life. Maybe that's what they thought. I don't know. But nowhere that I know of in the book of Kings or in the book of Samuel is there a question raised about having that thing in their house. That's the interesting thing. Just as with Jacob, there's no question raised, no issue about the fact God doesn't say to him, why did you take that matzeva and sanctify it as if I'm going to live in that rock? Are you crazy? You pagan you? He gets nothing, you know, it passes right through and big whoopee. But that's the point, you see. That's exactly the point. So if it wasn't a big whoopee for Jacob, then it's not a big whoopee for David. And one can point back, if the stories are edited at that time and people knew that David, if the word got out, you know, David, you know, and they said Jacob did something just as bad, maybe worse. So apparently it's okay, or at least it's not a big deal. Adultery, you know, and murder, yeah, that's big time. Okay, okay. Tybel, you took your hand down. Okay. Mark.
Well, I look at the expanse of Jewish history in such a way that over 4,000 years, from where we stand now, we have much more knowledge because it's been written down for 2,000 years. And if that's the midpoint, the Second Temple, and you go back in Jewish history, I think King David in his time was much closer to the time of the originators, you know, Jacob and Abraham in terms of time. And, of course, it was handed down orally from generation to generation and probably misinterpreted and watered down. So the knowledge wasn't very clear. Yeah. But over the expanse of that 4,000 years, we have believed in divinity in stones. I mean, look what people take the Western Wall to be. Those are stones. And they ascribe a certain amount of sanctification and holiness to a material object. So how much have we changed over 4,000 years?
That's a good point. And I accept that point. Absolutely. I think there is a tendency. Well, that's the whole issue we've been talking about, and that is that we are people who are governed by our senses. We are creatures of, we're material creatures. And our first recourse to figuring, to seeing things and experience things is based upon our senses, not what's in our brain, right? If you think about it, our instincts, mm-hmm. our animal instincts, which deal with physical weakness, hunger, you know, the fear of losing your life, these sort of very basic urges and needs govern our life much more than theology. We have to work hard at getting the theology to come into our life. We have to work hard to getting to think about ethics in our lives. The urge, animals' urge, I don't know that animals have a sense of ethics, right? Animals have a sense of preservation and preservation of their children, because that is instinctive part of survival of the species, right? So these are frontline stuff with us animals. We are animals in that regard. And the Bible is trying to create a whole other realm of existence, of experience and of knowledge and of understanding that transcends that and controls. I mean, the rabbis were right when they say, if you study Torah, it strengthens your Yetzer HaTov, your inclination for good, and that can control your Yetzer Hara, the inclination toward evil, which is not really evil. It's just the inclination toward the just living by your sensory self. And that's basically what Torah is supposed to be. So that people see holiness in a stone, in stones, yeah, that's our old instinct popping up. But the one difference is, I don't know. I've never spoken to the people who, I mean, I once put a little tzetel in the kotel. Okay. I did. But over time, what you said grew on me, and the notion of the quasi deification or divinification, whatever, sanctification of the stones became to me, it was more and more approaching a form of idolatry. I go occasionally, you know, but it's not the big thing for me. I like davening actually in the alternate area with the Masorti. We set up our Masorti synagogue on the. To me, that's much more meaningful because it's in the midst of an archaeological garden that has history in it. You know, and you see the results of sinfulness in the destruction that took place because some of the stones are clearly fell out of the wall when the Romans conquered it. So, I mean, that's to me very meaningful. So, yeah, but I think you're right in a sense, but there is still a difference. Nobody poured oil and sanctified the kotel, right? In other words, nobody said God is in the stones. Nobody has come right out and said that as far as I know. Mm-hmm. Say that the presence of God has been in what's behind the stones and underground, yes. And so by getting close to the stones, you say, well, maybe there's some residual divinity because it was all part of a sacred structure, right? Even though that retaining wall was not part of the temple at all.
It's a remnant, so it has right, some
exactly.
significance.
But the temple could not have been built where it was if that retaining wall wasn't there. So it's all part of the land, that whole area would have been considered sacred space, which it was. That's why you had to go down to the, you know, even David's temple. No, sorry, Herod's temple, right, we're talking that. That's why you had to go down to the Siloam pool and you know, go to mikveh before you came in. Okay? So, I mean, there are some people, I'm sure, who go to mikveh before they go to the kotel for that same reason. So the point is, it's a step back from idolatry. But the bottom line is, you're right. It's a quasi-idolatry. And it's that's our nature, and we have to control that.
So we have to cut David a little break, you know, because it's...
Well, I mean, the Bible does that as the Bible does Jacob.
Mm-hmm.
And that has something to do with the timing of when these things were written, which I will get to later. I think we can take a guess as to when these accounts were, when the ancient stories were redacted, and why when the parallel with David that was either created or, I mean, you know, what the process exactly was, we don't know. But the timing of all of that, I think, has something to do also with some of the issues related more historically with David. But I think, make a guess. I'm not going to say it now, though.
How far away in time was David from Jacob? 800 years? 400 years? Does anybody?
Jacob was David was 1,000 BCE, right?
1,200 BC or 1,000 something like that.
No. David is 1,000.
Mm-hmm.
Jacob, who knows?
2,000.
500 years earlier.
Uh huh.
I don't know. The problem is What is a generation? The only times we get that number 400 is a big number, right? Thank you. But that's the problem here, because you see, if you go back to that, so Abraham, 17, okay. Let's assume that you see the chart that the Tibbles put up? So there's Abe at 1737 BCE. Mm-hmm. David is down. Let's take that for a moment as an operating concept. David is down at 1,000. That's 700 years later.
Yeah, a lot goes on to miss the story from 700 years earlier. To,
yes, of course.
Significant.
That's right. The traditions, and nobody knows that the date of Abraham at all is correct. Nobody knows.
I thought it was 1736.
Well, you see, you were wrong. What? No, it depends if you're counting the beginning of the royal year or the end of the royal year, you know, or which royal, what calendar you're using. That's the point.
So it all
Mark, we got to move on. Okay.
Okay. One last comment. It all devolves into the realm of myth. So if David had trouble with that, imagine 4,000 years from the beginning, how we have to refer to myths that have been recreated by other people and their inspiration from the original founding event. It's just.
Yes. Okay. That's true. Yeah, of course. I mean, the point is the closer down you get in history, right? I mean, Islam, for example, the baby religion. Yeah. It's at a time when recording of history is much more, is done more efficiently, considerably more accurately. But at the same time, the concept of objective recording of what important people, impactful people say, was not as developed as it is today. And even today, we know, right, that factual recording in black and white of events and of history is not always accepted as being true. Some people say it's not true.
Well, are you saying that alternate facts have existed?
I am not making a political statement. Okay.
All right. Rabbi,
Mark. Somebody, there are two other people want to comment.
Okay.
All right. So, Bert and then Tybel.
I just wanted to reinforce, I found your statement about the experiential part of God as opposed to the intellectual part. I mean, after all, we're told not to worship other gods, among other reasons, who we have not experienced.
Yeah.
Not how we have not, like, intellectually been taught about. And the Exodus, we're supposed to experience that as well.
Right.
And I would submit that it's also possible for, God forbid, intellectual investigation to become a form of idolatry as well, to get away from the, I'm not talking about any discussion we're having, but there's always that balance between just the facts, ma'am, and the broader picture of experience and myth and other things that are not, you know, this is not history. Because part of what bothers me, and again, this is not a reflection on this conversation here today, but people who say, well, because you can't prove that X happened, you know, it says in the Torah, they were there 400 years. Because you can't prove that, therefore the Torah is not true, whatever that means.
Yeah.
No, that's beside the point.
No, right. Right. However, we still nonetheless seek concrete evidence for the ideas that we hold to be very important.
No question.
Because it validates us, yes. And so what we're saying is that the further you go back in time, the less available that evidence is not.
Without there. Getting political, what happened in the last election here? And that's what, 4 years ago, 3.5 years ago?
Yeah.
Not 3,000.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And people just, right. Okay, Tybel.
Two fast things. One, I just wanted to say I am so with Mark the first time I was at the Kotel was when I was 25, decades ago. And it wasn't in my Jewish lexicon, but I would now say to me, looking around, the whole thing was a Avodah Zarah. Even forgetting the Mechitza, but what went on, I just left. And I didn't do well with the Kotel until much later when I, for various reasons, including Women of the Wall, was at Robinson's Arch. And that I was moved by, because when I went past the trumpeting stone and knew it was the trumpeting stone from Tanakh and could see the marks of the fire from the Romans, that to me was an incredibly moving place to pray. That's one. And then the next thing I was going to say, believe it or not, despite disability, I am ready for you next time, Rabbi, when you make a joke. Here we go. I just put that together. So you won't feel unappreciated.
Thank you so much. Yes. Okay. All right. Okay, Mark, now I'll move on.
Okay, yeah, quickly. You know, you're a historian, and you know about historiography, and you know the truth is a prism. There's many different facets of minority opinions, majority opinions, and historians weigh variables to try and figure out what had the most influence to cause an event. So they figure it out, and everything else which might have significance drops by the wayside. So we have no insight into minority opinions or other trends.
That does happen. And sometimes minority opinions ultimately flip and become majority opinions as more evidence pops up.
Yeah.
Well, it's true. I mean, technically speaking, everybody should have the opportunity to look at the evidence. And that's why some of these conspiracy theories, which take little tiny shreds of things and plug them together and assume that there is an intrinsic connection between them without really demonstrating that connection does in fact exist. You know, so you see A does this and they're saying this. Oh, look, B does something similar. Oh, they must be connected. C, and you can see what's a conspiracy. They may never even talk to one another. Right? They did they ever meet? Was there an organization that brought them together? And somebody stood up in front and said to everybody, okay, guys, we are the, right?
It's a weakness of the human mind. When all else fails to explain existence, then you have to fabricate.
Yes. Yes. All right.
Okay.
Now, so we're now going to start looking at these parallels. And I was going to begin by reading to you some of the things that people, well, you know what? I'm going to skip this because we'll come back to it afterwards. We're going to look at a whole series of parallels that I found on my own. Okay. I will say that with nobody guiding me. And then I found out afterwards that a lot of them other people had already, you know, discovered. Excuse me. So what I'm going to be reviewing are a lot of them, some of the things they did not. Okay. And within the last month, I've been pulling up new articles that I just read by reading other articles where more of this has been done. So hopefully if I can review them all by next week, we'll talk. We may need to, let me just say right now, we may need to extend this class like we're doing with the Psalms class last night, a couple of weeks so we can finish this project. If it interests you, if you say this is boring, I got it, let's move on, fine. But I'd like to be able to really deeply get into this because it's fascinating. To me, it's fascinating. I see already two votes in favor. Thank you. All right, anyway. But it is because you're going to learn stuff, details about things outside the Torah, okay, that you probably never thought of before. You may have known the stories, but you never made these kinds of connections with a certain depth and gravitas that you never before. That's what happened to me. I got so excited when I said, oh my God, look at that. Oh my God, I was jumping all over the place. And I actually sent my very rough draft of this to Yair Zakovich, whose list is in my bibliography here, whose books and articles are here. He sent me back, said, this is very interesting. You know, he said, others have found things like this, but you've got some new stuff. go ahead, work on it. So that really gave me this was years ago. Okay, I haven't seen much more recently, but anyhow, all right. Okay, so, and I'm going to get your Bible out, get it out, loosen up your fingers, because we're going to be doing a lot of flipping. Remember, I told you to do what I did. Remember, I said last week, here's Jacob. That's just the beginning. And there's David. So you can quickly flip to the different parts of the Tanakh where we're going to go. All right.
Do we need Tanakh or just Torah?
Well, you need Tanakh, baby, because okay. We're going to David.
Okay.
And not everything that deals with David is in a Haftorah. So no, we'll look at the sources. All right. So now, excuse me. All right. So both, number one, very simple. This is going to be a very, very simple kind of thing. Both David and Jacob are the youngest child, the youngest sons. Yes. Okay. I mean, I don't know if we have to read that, but the fact is, if you read Genesis 25:19-26, it's clear, right? He comes out second. And 1 Samuel 16:11-13, it's clear that of the sons of Jesse, David was the youngest. So they are the youngest sons. Okay, and and normally the burden of next generation responsibility devolves upon the oldest, right?
The oldest, yeah.
What's interesting is that this paradigm, I mean, Solomon, in the list from I think from Chronicles, Solomon is the youngest of his sons, of David's sons. Okay, there's no question he's not the oldest, but he's among the youngest of the sons. Okay, and clearly, excuse me, was Isaac the oldest son?
Well, it depends on which, if when the mother counts, yes, but no, because there's Ishmael.
That's right. Yeah, exactly. And from Abraham's perspective, remember this, from Abraham's perspective, Ishmael was the first son that he circumcised, because he circumcised him before Isaac was born. So Abraham, as far as Abraham knew, I mean, he had a real stake in Ishmael. And he's hesitant. You know, he basically, when Hagar is sent away twice, right, he doesn't butt in. Okay, he doesn't butt in. And he's basically, and God tells, it's the second time God says, listen to Sarah. I'll take care of Hagar and her son. That's when she kicks him out. You know, kicks them both out. Okay, because she saw something that was wrong. Okay, all right. And then Jacob himself, right, is the youngest between Jacob and Esau, right? And that, as we know, became very dicey, because it's clear that Isaac favored Esau. Okay, and we're not even sure that Rebekah told her husband what God had told her, that the elder would serve the younger. Okay? So there too. And where does Joseph fall?
He's the older if you look at the mother, but he's 11 of 12 sons.
It's not that mother doesn't count from Jacob's perspective. Sorry about that.
11 of 12.
Right?
Joseph.
Right, exactly. So he's the oldest of the two youngest, but he's the youngest. And if you think about it, Reuben, Shimon, Levi, Yehuda, of the first four of Leah's sons, Leah has two others later, but of the first four, the real big ones, Judah is the youngest. And which two tribes come to dominate the history of Israel? Judah and Ephraim, right? Who's Joseph's youngest son? Remember, Yes, that's right. Ephraim and Manasseh were born. Yes. Menashe was the oldest, yes? And who ultimately was the one who gets the blessing with the right hand? It's Ephraim. So same thing, right? So there's a whole pattern of that's all counter history, if you will. It's counter tradition, okay? And in fact, to the point where even in the book of Deuteronomy, in the law code in Deuteronomy, it says, if a man has two wives, the one he loves and the one he doesn't love, and the one he doesn't love gives birth to the eldest child, says quite clearly, who is the firstborn who gets all the rights? The firstborn, regardless of who the mother was. And it makes clear that's the rule, because it hadn't been clarified apparently beforehand. It's only in the book of Deuteronomy. So that's a big deal. Okay, Tybel.
Just a fast one. If you look at the names, the one of that was so obvious on the face that the younger would serve the older. Ephraim, which means fruitful, versus Menashe, which means stranger. Who are you going to go with?
Wait, say that again. Ephraim?
Ephraim, which means fruitful.
Oh.
And Menashe, which means stranger. We don't even need to get to that narrative in chapter 49. As soon as we see the names, it's like, here we go again.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I never thought about that. Yeah, interesting. Mm-hmm. Yes, good. Okay, now, and again, I think this is something we don't have to spend time running around looking at. It's obvious. Both Jacob and David shared a profession. What were they?
Shepherds. They knew how it was better than herding cats.
Yes. They were shepherds. Okay. There you go. And who else was a shepherd? Moshe. Right? He watched his father-in-law's flocks. Where was the burning bush? Why was it that Moses confronted God with the burning bush? What was he doing on the mountain? Right? One of the sheep, one of the little Shepselech, got away. And he was such a wonderful shepherd, he went up the mountain to get the sheep and bring it back. Right? Now, he may not have been as advanced in his breeding as Jacob was. Jacob was a genius, right? And we don't know about David. David killed lions in order to save the sheep. That's how he learned to use his slingshot. Right? So, I mean, they were all shepherds. And by the way, there's something of note here. I'm going to jump sort of further down, but just to keep in mind the triad here of Moses and Jacob and David. How many biblical heroes or important people give, as they're dying, leave a verbal legacy? Moses, Jacob, and David. Moses, look at the end of the Devarim, right? Ha'azinu. That's Moses' poem. And even the blessings and curses that he gives at the end, part of his last legacy. Okay? Now, what happens with Jacob? Okay, he too gives blessings and curses at the end of his life, while he's on his deathbed. And so does David. It's not the same, but he gives instructions to Shlomo what to do with the various people who were good to him or who were bad to him. And he says, take care of the good ones and kill the bad ones. Okay? The point is, there's nobody else, as far as I know, reference the deathbed, what shall we say? Final words, a message, instruction.
A legacy.
Yeah, it's a verbal legacy. It's what I said beforehand. Exactly. The three of them. Interesting, isn't it? So, but we're going to focus more on David and Jacob. Okay, so both were shepherds. Now, this is a real interest. Now you're going to have to open your Bibles. Okay, so Here's the, first, I'll tell you what it is, then we're going to look. All right. Each is a child or great, 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 great child of a woman who wore a veil that led to the consummation of a sexual act with the man who would be his father or ancestor. About whom am I speaking? Well, who are the two women?
Tamar? Is one Tamar because she hid her identity so Tamar Judah would think she was a male prostitute?
And Tamar, whose daughter-in-law was, whose father-in-law was Judah.
Judah. And the other is, are you going to say Leah because she had to hide she wasn't her sister? Leah was veiled, right?
No. That was at night. It took place at night. She wasn't veiled.
She wasn't veiled on the wedding night?
Doesn't say anything about that.
No.
The word is not used.
I thought that's why brides were traditionally veiled at weddings, at Jewish weddings.
But at night, it doesn't matter. It's dark.
Oh.
No. Rebecca.
When was she veiled? At the well?
When she comes and she takes a look and she first sets eyes on her husband-to-be, on Isaac. It says, Vatitras imat sa'if. She covers her face with a veil. And then they meet. And the next thing we know is he's taking her into Sarah's tent, presumably to consummate the marriage. The use of the sa'if, and that's a term, the biblical word sa'if is used only three times in the whole Bible. In Genesis 24, and twice in Genesis 38. Isn't that interesting? Now look at Genesis 24, okay? Breishit Kaftala, Genesis 24, all right? And let's look starting at, I have here verse, yes, it's a long parsha. Right, so go to verse 65, okay? Genesis 24, 65. Are you there? Everybody there? Okay, everybody's there. So what does it say? All right. All right, Bert, why don't you read? So she got off the camel. Oh, by the way, I love this line. Okay. It says in verse 64, so Rivka raised her eyes, saw Isaac. She alighted from the camel. But the Hebrew is Vatipol me'al hagamal. Technically, if Verit Hoppenstein were here, she would tell you that Vatipol is from the Hebrew word nafal, which means she fell off of the camel.
She fell right off the camel.
And then now get ready, Tybel, get ready with your screen. She is the first woman in written history who fell for her husband.
And I thought you were going to say it was love at first sight. That's why she fell over.
Good. Okay. Love at first sight. And she fell for him.
Sounds like a euphemism. She fell off her camel.
That's right. Yes. Right. Camels are definitely taller than donkeys. All right. Anyhow. Now look at, okay, so Bert, now.
Okay, so she fell, she whatever it off, and said to the servant, who's that man walking in the field toward us? And the servant said, that's my master. So she took her veil and covered herself.
There it is. Sa'it, okay? Vaisaper avidly Yitzchak et kol, I'm sorry. Verse, that's the end of verse 65. Vatikat Sa'if, Tzadi Ayin Yud Fe Sofit. That's the word. Okay. So go on, 66, what does it say? So the servant
told Isaac all the things that he had done. Isaac then brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he took Rebekah as his wife. Isaac loved her and thus found comfort after his mother's death.
Right. Okay.
That always seemed strange to me. That he took his new wife into his mother's tent.
And exactly. And comfort his mother. And he found comfort in this. Yes, I always say he needed to see a psychologist.
He was a mother's boy.
No, he was having bereavement trauma. You know, I mean, he at a certain point you got to let go. You know. All right. Okay. So that's that. Now I want you to turn to Shmuel Aleph, 1 Samuel. Go over here to 1 Samuel, and I want you to turn to Genesis chapter 38, Judah and Tamar. And we're looking at verses 13 to 19. Okay. All right. Mark, are you there?
Yes.
Well, please read verses 13 to 19.
And Tamar was told, "Your father-in-law is coming up to Timnah for the sheep shearing." So she took off her widow's garb, covered her face with a veil.
Ah, there it is. Batichas, same word.
Mm-hmm.
Tsa'if, the Tsa'if. Yes, Tsa'if. You look at the Hebrew, verse 14. Batichas, Batsa'if. The same Hebrew word in both instances. She covered her face with a veil. Exact same wording. Go ahead.
Okay. And wrapping herself up, sat down at the entrance to Anaim, which is on the road to Timnah, for she saw that Shelah was grown up. Yet she had not been given to him as a wife.
Shelah was the third son. Okay, the other two had died. And he had promised Tamar, according to the laws of what you do with the surviving son marries the deceased's intended or wife, right? That whole process of maintaining the integrity of the male line in the family. All right? Levirate marriage, it's called.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the brother, the brother of the deceased marries the deceased's wife or intended to be wife. So she was happy to do that, but Jacob apparently was afraid because the first two died. Okay, the first two died. And so Shelah was the one left, and Judah had not yet fulfilled his obligation to give Shelah to Tamar or give Tamar to Shelah so that they could marry and have children. That was, and so Tamar wanted to make sure that that was done. I mean, she also may have been thinking of the needs for her own security as well. Let's give her some, you know, that's very possible. But still, she was the one she's doing this in order to fulfill that. This is not going to endear her necessarily. And she didn't know what the reactions were going to be, and we're going to see they were pretty, the initial reactions were very disturbing. But in the end, Judah says to her, "You're right. You are justified more than I." He admits that. Okay. All right. Tybalt, quickly.
From a genealogist's perspective, it's not just the marriage. It's the fact that the first child born will be named after the deceased brother. So his name continues for a generation.
Yes, that's true. Right.
It's the naming. It's not the...
Well, but the name is symbolic, though, of the line. That's the thing, okay? Because it'll be the house of Shelah. Yes, I mean that means when Judah dies, it's now the house of Judah. It'll become the house of Shelah. Yes, but it goes along with the dignity of the household and the family. It's just larger than the name itself. The name carries with it gravitas. That's the point. You're right, but it's the name and what it means in terms of representing the heritage of what's being passed down, and it ensures also that the idea being that the next firstborn son would then take over for the father. That's the whole concept behind it. Eventually, of course, it was dropped because it just couldn't work. That's much later on. All right, so now let's finish this up, though. Go ahead. Go ahead, Mark.
Okay, what line did I get to?
So verse 15. Shelah had grown up, and she had not yet been given him as a wife.
Okay, when Judah saw her, he took her for a harlot, for she had covered her face. So he turned aside to her by the road and said, "Here, let me sleep with you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. Boy, what intrigue.
He was his daughter-in-law, and the point is, technically speaking, it was not his job to sleep with her. Now we're going to see at the end, it seems to have done the job, which may suggest, because, I mean, theoretically, he should have been condemned himself in the end. He should have realized, "Oh, my God, you made me sin." Right? But in the end, when he realizes why she did that, he's going to say, "Oh, you are more justified than I." Right? Because he realized that she was doing what his job for him, in the sense of making sure that this happened.
Mm-hmm. And had he not met her?
What?
Had he not met his daughter-in-law?
Of course he did. He knew her, but he couldn't tell it was her. That's why she got dressed up like this.
Oh, my God.
Okay.
Oh, wait.
It's the story. Okay.
He met him, but you got to realize, if you read these stories carefully enough, mm-hmm. the men and the women, they were almost two separate camps. Mm-hmm. And you, Jake, when you read the stories of Rachel and Leah, they have to make an arrangement for somebody to go into his tent in order to have intercourse. They don't sleep together. It's like the king and queen of England. You know, they each have their own quarters. Really. I mean, but this is not even in the same tent. There's the women's tent and the men's tent. And so he knew who she was, but obviously the way she, her demeanor, whatever it was.
And he wasn't expecting her. He wasn't expecting a harlot to be his daughter-in-law.
He may have thought to himself, it's like when Isaac realized, well, did he or did he not know that Jacob came for the blessing? It's a question.
Mm-hmm.
It, based upon what he said, you might think that maybe he got an inkling. Well, we don't know that here, though. Flatly, he just did not recognize it as her. Clearly, he had never seen her. You know, he had never had any physical relationship with her. And, you know, she was the wife of, you know, his daughter-in-law, but that was his son's business, not his. So, you know, that's I think that's the understanding here. Go on.
Okay. Boy, what devious behavior is revealed in our tradition? I don't think anybody else.
I mean, it is suggested that it may be, what this reflects is that if push came to shove, it's possible that the father-in-law could actually play the role of the Levirate husband.
Well, that's the genesis of all our genetic difficulties.
Now, right, of course. Well, but the point is, though, yes and no, because he's married. He's doing it with a woman who's not genetically related.
Right.
Jesus. Okay. Right. What she asked, will you pay for sleeping with me? He replied, "I will send a kid for my flock." But she said, "You must leave a pledge until you have sent it." So she got it in writing or verbally?
Well, go ahead. Read on.
No, okay. She got his staff.
Oh, read on. Okay.
And he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" She replied, "Your seal and cord and the staff which you carry." Mm. So he gave them to her and slept with her. She conceived by him. Oh, my God. Then she went on her way. She took off her veil and again put on her widow's garb. What an operator, my God.
Right. No, and so you're going to see in the end that's going to save her life. She knew what she was doing.
Wow.
She was a smart lady.
Yeah, how did it affect her relationship with Shelah, though? I mean, whose baby is she carrying? I mean, it didn't matter, I guess.
It's irrelevant. It's irrelevant.
Mm.
It's irrelevant.
And,
No, he probably was hesitant because the other two brothers died. Maybe there's a curse.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of an underlying current in the story itself, you know.
And one brother's name goes down for generations for a very bad thing. Onanism.
Yes.
You know?
Exactly, right. That's because he spilled his seed. That's because the non-completion of the act. It's spilling the seed outside of the womb. That's onanism, right? And Onan died, and so did Er. The first two died. And Er did something bad, and Onan did something bad. That's the whole point. Now, the fact is we don't know what the bad, we're going to get back to this a little bit later on. Let me look at the names. The first one that said he did something bad. Okay. With Onan, we know what he did bad. Coitus interruptus, right? That's bad because you're spilling seed that should have gone inside. And he did not fulfill his obligation. So he died. So now here comes Shelah. And he's wondering, geez, what am I going to do here? Should I take her? Should I not take her? You know, because Er, we don't know what he did bad that had anything to do with her. Why did he die? He did something, all it says he did something wrong, something bad. So Shelah was obviously quite confused. And so he said, I better stay away from this girl. And that one can see that happening. It doesn't say that explicitly, but one can see that happening. So that's the thing. And what Jacob, Judah should have done was just step right in, you know, and then did what he had to do in terms of Shelah. But he didn't. We're going to get back to that a little bit later. All right. I'm going to stop right here. Okay.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.